Hey, this is Gary Suarez, and you're listening to Full Service Radio. A lot of the artists you love became part of your world because somebody paid somebody to make it happen. It isn't necessarily because they were the best at it. I don't care if we call them goats now. A lot of those guys got here through ways that certainly weren't fair in the process. I didn't set out to be a journalist in music or otherwise. I went to school for business. I wanted to be a marketer, and I did that for quite a number of years, but I wrote about music on the side, and everything I learned about this stuff was very seat of the pants. I kind of took sales and marketing ideas and applied them to what I was doing, and particularly one of the most obvious examples of that is writing in brand voice. You know, when you're writing for publications, you don't always have the chance to write as yourself, even if your byline is attached to it. You're writing in the voice of that publication. And the ability to adapt to speak to an audience is hugely important. And a lot of writers, young and old, don't get that. And I do love when there's a chance to actually use my voice. But for the most part, a lot of what I do, if I'm writing something at Forbes, there is a tone that I use there. If I'm writing for Vice, something totally different. You know, and you know, some people would throw phrases like code switching around, but for me, it's about writing in a brand voice, which is what keeps me getting steady work. I don't think I have one primary beat. If I had to say I did for a purpose, hip hop generally is one. But the truth is, it's hard to specialize and make a living in this. I think some people will look at my Twitter account and think that it's performative. I think that I'm doing a bit. My Twitter account is a side of me that maybe doesn't come across if you meet me in a bar, but it is very much me and what I think. And I've used that because I felt as if it was an avenue that I could express myself this way. When you write, you don't necessarily write as yourself. However, by having a channel that does that, it does signal to people what you can do, what you stand for, and, you know, in my experience, it gets you work. It's about recognizing what works on Twitter. By posing questions, by polling people, by asking people to rank things, they can't help themselves. Everybody has a fucking opinion, and they almost always suck, but they have them, and they can't help themselves. So music fans are notorious about it. So, like, if you ask people, like, every 2 days someone's ranking Kanye West albums, like, it's really a pointless activity, but people can't help themselves. So I posed a question that was very much in line with a piece I was writing at the time. I had this in line. I said, who has the best 4-album run in hip hop? My answer was in the can because I was writing it, and it was Ice-T and Ice-T's first 4 albums. But the answers I got were predominantly Outkast, some variant of Kanye, A Tribe Called Quest, just these sort of answers. And what happened was I took the 3 most predictable ones and told everybody who said them that they were wrong, which only made people angrier, and it made them demand my answer. So when I gave them my answer, they were all aghast. How? And you know the rationale is they have no knowledge of this discography. They don't know Ice-T's music, which was the point of the piece that I was writing, is you know who he is, he's on television, but you don't necessarily know his music. So when I actually dropped the piece, and that's basically the lead, is best 4-album run in hip-hop, people who follow the Twitter account are like, oh, that's what you were doing. I've learned that criticism is devalued by these outlets. You can't pitch reviews. There's a handful of places that write reviews, that publish reviews. There's a handful of places that publish reviews that will pay for them, but most won't. So if you want to do a review, the savvy pitcher presents it as a think piece or otherwise looks at content that the site regularly publishes and slots the idea in there. So my case is I look at Noisy, a publication that I write for very frequently, and I say, you have a series of guides, and it's a guide to getting into blank artist. And really, it's essentially music criticism. You can present that in a listicle format, and you can present it as, you know, however the format requires. But I'm able to push forward a review that would have been maybe a critical essay at some point, but just presented it differently. The RIAA said that 93% of revenue generated for Latin music in the United States is from streaming. So that's something that gets overlooked, the fact that this consumption is happening here in the United States, and it is predominantly by people who either are Spanish speakers, come from families that are Spanish speaking, or come from cultures that are Spanish speaking. They aren't necessarily fluent. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we treat these things separately based on language. So when Latin Trap emerged, it wasn't being discussed by English language publications. It was still like, well, that's like reggaeton, and reggaeton is old, which was already a joke because reggaeton was a thriving international sound. That just because you couldn't remember the last time that you heard a reggaeton song on the radio, on the pop radio, didn't mean that it wasn't happening. It was huge everywhere. But with the rise of artists like Bad Bunny and J Balvin and Ozuna and all of these others, it made it impossible to ignore. And I started evangelizing. And I fortunately had platforms with which to evangelize and say, this is important, this is important. So when Cardi B had the number one song in the country and 2/3 of it was in Spanish, I was able to say, hi, I was right. And I'm not shy about admitting that I was right. I was right. You're not going to love everything that a 13, 14, 50-year-old is enjoying. You're not going to love everything that a teenager is going to enjoy as somebody who's writing about contemporary hip-hop. But there's very little exciting about staying mired in the past. You're going to find that these kids, their influences are not necessarily what you think or want them to be. And the end results may not necessarily be what you want them to be, but you have to, at a minimum, respect what they're doing. I hate when people dismiss a lot of these younger artists as mumble rappers or say that they're not lyrical. And I think that's fine as a criticism and say, okay, well, they're not really doing, you know, what we did. They're not doing ciphers like we did. That's a criticism you can have. But I liken that as somebody who thinks about music beyond genre and beyond what mattered to me as a teenager and what mattered to me as a 20-something. If you actually genuinely love hip hop, there is something for you right now from somebody who is in their teens or 20s doing it right now. It exists. It's here for you. It may not necessarily be getting the radio play. It may not be what's on the Billboard Hot 100. It may not be what your nephew is listening to or your niece is listening to, but it's happening right now. You're going to enjoy it. The thing is, you have these elder statesmen that are still alive right now, and you have their devotees who are still alive right now, but they're not necessarily what's driving this business. And so we can't let a genre as vibrant and diverse and eclectic and inclusive as hip hop be defined by any one style. That's regressive mindset. If you do feel that way, if you're not feeling any of what the younger generation's doing right now in hip hop, for the love of God, don't write about this stuff anymore. Don't be that guy.